Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at a controversial temple being built on a contested holy site in India. Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi is opening what's been dubbed a Hindu Vatican. What does it mean for Hindus, for Muslims, and for Mr. Modi's political ambitions this election year? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 22nd of January, these are our main stories. Tensions spill over in Jerusalem as Israeli families of hostages being held in Gaza storm Israel's parliament. Why the Indian Prime Minister's attendance at the opening of a Hindu temple is proving controversial, and
we know that these can save tens of thousands of lives, and over time that turns into millions of lives.
After 30 years of research, a life-changing malaria vaccine is launched in Cameroon. And also later, the Oscars nominations are soon to be announced.
This is Oscar night.
Congratulations, welcome to
this whole thing, the awards and all that is silly. And I think we have to accept that silliness.
But many in Hollywood are pondering the ceremony's relevance in an increasingly divided world. We start in Jerusalem, where there have been furious scenes inside Israel's parliament, the Knesset. A group of relatives of hostages held in Gaza broke through security and stormed a finance committee session, some of them shouting, "Shame on you." They're demanding the government do more to secure the release of hostages abducted on October the 7th by Hamas. Israel says around 130 people are still being held in Gaza. Since then, more than 25,000 Palestinians have been killed there, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Over the past 24 hours, there's been fierce fighting in the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis. A short time ago, I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen.
Today, Mondays, are committee days in the Knesset. Various committees meet. And so what we think has happened is that the relatives of the hostages were invited either by a member of the Knesset or indeed by another committee. They appear quite regularly inside the parliament. And then after that appearance, they broke through security into this finance committee. One of them shouted, "We won't let you breathe until our kids come back." Another held a placard saying, "You will not sit here while they die there." There is an increasing sense of trauma spilling over into rage here and frustration, particularly directed towards Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself, who many of the relatives of the hostages feel is not doing enough to prioritise their release.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ruled out any end to the war until Hamas is destroyed. So what chances are there for the hostages to be freed?
There is talk that a new diplomatic effort is underway involving Egypt and Qatar and the US to try to mediate a second hostage release deal. You'll remember back in the end of November, there was a deal in which about 100 hostages were released at that stage in return for about 250 Palestinian prisoners being released from Israeli jails. Since then, diplomatic efforts have stalled in trying to reach a second deal, but there is an attempt to try to get the two sides talking again. But as you say, Benjamin Netanyahu is being pretty defiant on this. In fact, last night, on Sunday night, he gave a news conference saying that he would not agree any deal deal with, as he called them, Hamas monsters that would allow Hamas to stay in control of Gaza and force Israel to withdraw its troops, because in his words, that would mean that Israeli soldiers in Gaza had died in vain. So the two sides are still a chasm, a gulf apart, but there are attempts to try to at least get them talking in some way, even through back channels.
Mark, street battles in Khan Yunis.
The BBC estimates that about 75% of Khan Yunis is now under Israeli control. That is the largest city in southern Gaza, and it is very much the focus of the Israeli military campaign now, because Israel believes that the top Hamas commanders in Gaza are holed up in or beneath Khan Yunis. We're getting reports as well that Israeli tanks have surrounded some medical facilities there. The Palestinian Red Crescent, for example, says it has lost contact with staff at one of its hospitals, and the health ministry in Gaza, which is run by Hamas, said that 50 people were killed and 100 wounded in overnight shelling and overnight bombardment around Khan Yunis. So very much that is the focus of the Israeli offensive as it pushes on.
Mark Lowen in Jerusalem. Let's go to India now, where the Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been taking part in a ceremony to inaugurate a controversial Hindu temple at Ayodhya. Dressed in traditional golden-coloured robes, he unveiled a black stone idol to the deity Ram.
Shri Ram Ram Raghunandan Ram Ram Shri Ram Ram Bharata.
Today's consecration was broadcast to millions of people across the country. It's considered by many to be the unofficial start of Mr. Modi's campaign for re-election. He described the temple's opening as a new era for India. The temple is controversial because more than 30 years ago, a 16th century mosque on the same site was torn down by Hindu mobs to make room for it. Earlier, I spoke to our reporter in Ayodhya, Nitin Srivastava.
The mosque, as you rightly said, was there standing tall until 6th of December 1992, when it was razed down by thousands of Hindu mobs. Hindus here have always claimed this to be the birthplace of their Lord Rama, whereas the Muslims say that this has been a place of worship, a mosque, ever since the 16th century Mughal Emperor Babur built that mosque here. Of course, it has been a long-standing dispute, almost 200 years old. The matter has been in court even before India's independence. But then, after 92, prayers were stopped here, and the matter again went back to the highest court. And after decades of legal battle, legal struggle, arguments and hearings, the Supreme Court of India, the top court, ruled that the site, the disputed site, will be given to Hindus to build a temple, which is almost 70 acres if we measure it up. And then they also said that there will be a separate site given to Muslims to build a mosque. Today, what has happened, many Hindus see this as a culmination of that long struggle, which also looks to be slightly political in color, because as you said, the general elections are not very far. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in India, led by the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has always championed the cause of the Ram Temple here. And this is perhaps why he referred to this as the beginning of a new era.
Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister, the head of the governing BJP, it's being widely seen as the start of his re-election campaign.
That's right. The BJP is never, the ruling BJP rather, has never shied away from it. Building a Ram temple in this disputed site, even when the matter was sub judice, has always been in the BJP's political agenda, and they have clearly spelt it in their manifesto, election manifesto, for almost 15, 20 years now. And that is why, in spite of a lot of debate and discussion and criticism, the Prime Minister were here to sort of be a part of the inauguration.
Nitin Srivastava. And if you'd like to hear more on this story and about the history and politics of the temple at Ayodhya, you can listen to our podcast, The Global Story, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. It's being called a global milestone. After 30 years of research, Cameroon is launching the world's first routine vaccine programme against malaria. There are about 6 million cases of the mosquito-borne disease every year in Cameroon, causing around 4,000 deaths, most of them children under five. The RTS-S vaccine will go out across 42 districts following successful pilot campaigns in Kenya, Ghana and Malawi. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy has been covering the story.
Today is such a moment on the continent and also globally. We're talking about a disease that has killed so many people, most of them children, and that could change now that we have the first vaccine being deployed. We are expecting the second one to be deployed around mid this year. I live in Kenya. I've grown up in Kenya. And sometimes you meet somebody saying, I feel like I have malaria. It's synonymous with disease. That's how common it is. And therefore, this could really be a game changer for people. And there have been concerns about potential vaccine hesitancy. That is not likely in comparison to, you know, when the COVID vaccine was being deployed, you know, having spoken to people in different parts of the, I've covered this for many years. I can expect that there will be demand from the people themselves.
Anne Soy. The World Health Organization's Director of Immunization, Kate O'Brien, told my colleague Sana Safi she was optimistic the vaccine's introduction would regain control of one of the world's deadliest diseases.
It's maybe a little bit hard for people to understand who don't live in a malaria area, the threat that malaria poses for families, the present threat day in and day out for the loss of a child, the loss of income to care for a sick child, or even just the trying to find the cost of treatment. So having two safe and effective vaccines to add to the armamentarium of other malaria prevention tools is really game-changing.
What is it like to live with malaria and to have malaria or go through it?
Young children especially are at risk from really serious outcomes, meaning death. They suffer terribly with vomiting, high fever. They can become seriously ill really quickly, have seizures, difficulty breathing, and even severe anemia requiring an emergency blood transfusion if you can get it. And in areas of malaria risk, almost everybody you meet has lost a family member or a loved one to malaria.
And we understand there are further promising malaria treatments down the line. There must be a real mood of optimism within the community, within the health community and in your surrounding as well.
Well, there's real excitement around this, but I really want to emphasize that malaria vaccines, like every malaria intervention, are imperfect. You can't replace the efforts that are being made already in communities using bed nets and other interventions. This is about layering on an additional intervention. And this is also a big signal to scientists and manufacturers all around the world that the world wants malaria vaccines and will invest in innovations that are going to get malaria control back on track. We know that these can save tens of thousands of lives, and over time that turns into millions of lives.
The WHO's Kate O'Brien. The Russian occupiers in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk say 130,000 people are without power following reports of Ukrainian drone attacks on electricity substations. The power cuts are also affecting heating and water supplies. Donetsk is holding a day of official mourning for 27 people killed in the shelling of a market area on Sunday. Drones have become an increasingly deadly weapon in the Russian war against Ukraine. But with major military aid packages currently blocked in both the US and European Union, Ukraine has been forced to get civilians working from home involved in their assembly. Our correspondent James Waterhouse has been to see what difference they're making on the southern Kherson battlefield, the only part of Ukraine where Kyiv is on the offensive.
It's not often you see territory occupied by Russia with the naked eye, but on this approach to the Dnipro River, you can. We're heading towards the Antonivsky Bridge, once used by retreating Russian forces at the end of 2022. We're meeting the 11th Brigade of the National Guard, which deals in air reconnaissance. And in these parts, that means forcing Russian troops back with attack drones.
We just had some incoming fire. When you're this close to the river, which is a front line, you are always watched through drones in the sky or from the Russians themselves, so you have to move quickly. Okay, they want us to go down here.
This is our guys, the Philippine pilots.
Inside, we meet Timur, the commander of his Samosu drone squad.
From this location, we try to restrain the enemy's offensive and any movements. With one FPV drone that costs from $400 to $600, you can hit a target that will be 100 times more expensive than a drone.
We've moved from the hostile exterior through some double doors into what feels like a living room initially, but there's a deep, striking military feel. We have drone pilots sat in armchairs in front of two TVs with what looks like a console controller. There's a can of energy drink, and on the floor here are a dozen or so drones carrying artillery shells.
We've now received information that several enemy FPV drones have taken off from the location we know. We're flying there right now.
So the pilot is navigating his drone, but you can see the propellers either side of the view. He's moving through the low-lying marshland, which sits on the eastern bank of the Dnipro River, and it's essentially a mirror image. He's trying to find the equivalent on the other side of the river.
Telemetry recovered.
So that's hit.
Destroyed.
So you've just destroyed an enemy antenna. What effect does that have on the Russians?
We've destroyed their drone control system, and now they won't be able to fly in our direction.
It takes 14 hours of flying to essentially become a drone pilot in this war. They're practicing with plastic bottles, which imitate the grenades that they will drop on the enemy. And only a few kilometres from here, they're being used for real.
Stitch is the commander of a drone unit in the territorial defence, and he oversees the training.
Can you explain how important drones have become?
This is a new type of war ongoing now. We are currently engaging in an active battle of technologies, an arms race. During the First World War, aviation was born, so now we are starting the future war of drones, which in two decades may simply turn the tide of any war.
James Waterhouse. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
So you can imagine for them that kind of odd environment that they were brought up in, you know, the social restriction, the fact that they didn't get to do the normal stuff that dogs are expected to do on a day-to-day basis.
Were you one of the millions of people who bought a puppy during COVID? New research suggests our lockdown pets may have a few behavioural issues that need ironing out.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at a controversial temple being built on a contested holy site in India. Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi is opening what's been dubbed a Hindu Vatican. What does it mean for Hindus, for Muslims, and for Mr. Modi's political ambitions this election year? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the story of a powerful Nigerian televangelist.
He was a huge celebrity and had a way of presenting himself as man of God.
Who attracted followers to his church from around the globe.
It was like going to heaven and being asked to stay.
But once there, some say that TB Joshua used his power to control, manipulate and abuse. This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Disciple.
We all thought we were in heaven, but we were in hell, and in hell, terrible things happen.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
China's Xi Jinping has called for all-out rescue efforts in the province of Yunnan, where a landslide has buried at least 47 people. At the time of recording, at least 8 people had been confirmed dead and dozens are still missing in sub-zero temperatures. I heard more from our correspondent in Beijing, Laura Bicker.
This is in a small rural area in China's Yunnan province. Yunnan province right down in the southwest of the country, and it's right in the northwest of that mountainous province. It happened just before dawn, and witnesses have told Chinese state media that the mountain just seemed to collapse as people slept. And we can see on state media pictures of rescuers, hundreds of them combing through rubble, mortar, bricks, houses that have collapsed to try to find find anyone who has survived. As you said there, at least 47 people are missing in the rubble from 18 separate households. But what we have heard from Chinese state media over the last few hours is they have managed to rescue a few people alive, one person alive at least, but they are now racing against time. It's coming into the evening time here, it's about to be dark, and we're dealing with plunging temperatures. Temperatures in that region usually don't go too far below freezing, but at this moment they are well below freezing. There's a huge cold snap covering most of China, and especially at Yunnan province. So that's the kind of issue that rescuers have to deal with.
So not only the really cold temperatures, but because it's so remote, the rescue equipment that you would need in an operation like this just won't be there.
Well, China does have experienced rescue teams, and they seem to be able to mobilise very quickly. But yes, it must be very, very difficult to get everything that they need there as soon as possible. And they know that they need to get people trapped underneath the rubble. I think one of the other things is that this region is prone to landslides. It is a very mountainous region that sits right on the edge of the Himalayan plateau. So it is prone to landslides, and they are used to dealing with this. However, I think certainly, as you heard there from President Xi's orders, he is urging rescuers to do everything they can to make sure they bring as many people out of the rubble alive as soon as possible.
Laura Bicker. A month-long fishing ban has come into force off the French Atlantic coast. It affects all boats over 8 metres in length, fishing with most kinds of nets. It's been put in place to protect dolphins, more and more of which have been washing up on French beaches. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
It's the first time since World War II that there's been such an extensive fishing ban in the Bay of Biscay, with some 450 French boats, and many non-French ones too, confined to port or obliged to seek their catch elsewhere. Environmentalist groups that brought the legal action that led to the ban are delighted. They say that the number of dolphins being caught in nets and dying, mainly at this time of year, is increasing dramatically. Around 1,300 dolphins washed up on French beaches last winter, but that, say the groups, is only a fraction of the number that are killed. Fishermen, on the other hand, and others who live from their work, are angry. They say that the ban is unnecessary because dolphins in the Bay of Biscay are not endangered, and that the promised government compensation is not enough.
Hugh Schofield. Now, were you one of the millions of people around the world that bought a puppy during the pandemic? Many of us thought a puppy would help us get through those tough times. But new research suggests lockdown puppies have a higher rate of problem behaviours, including separation anxiety and aggression towards other dogs. The study from the Royal Veterinary College here in the UK surveyed more than 1,000 owners who bought puppies in the 2020 lockdown. Dr. Rowena Packer, who led this study, spoke to the BBC's Rick Edwards.
The puppies that were born and raised during that period, it's really crucial, the kind of first 16 weeks of their life is their kind of blueprint for the world, for the future. So you can imagine for them that kind of odd environment that they were brought up in, you know, the social restriction, the fact that they didn't get to do the normal stuff that dogs are expected to do on a day-to-day basis made us worry that going forward these dogs wouldn't be able to cope with the regular world that we now live in. So this was our initial reasoning for actually starting this cohort and starting to see what was going to happen to them as they got older.
So you were asking owners if you were seeing problem behaviours. What kind of things are we talking about?
We're thinking of a whole range of things. So common things like pulling on the leads, jumping up at people, running away when they're out on a walk, through to the more serious issues like aggression towards their owners or strangers or other dogs. So we looked at a range of 24 different issues, and on average, dogs had 5 issues, but actually about a fifth of dogs had 8 or more. So we're seeing a really high level in this population.
Can you turn this around still?
I think there's huge potential too, and I think that's a key thing to get across, is that there's plenty of behavioural professionals out there who are well qualified, who it's not an overnight thing, and I think that's an important expectation to set, but they can work with you, they can get to the bottom of what the kind of emotional causes of these issues are, and many of these issues can be resolved.
What do you suggest for separation anxiety.
It's a complicated issue that needs a really kind of systematic, slow and steady approach. It's not just getting them used to leaving by just leaving them. If they have a problem, it's basically a panic disorder. When they're left, they don't have that company with them and they go into a panic. So the first thing to do with all these kind of issues would be to see your vet. Your vet will be more than happy to talk to you and refer you to somebody who can help. There's also many different psychological drugs for dogs as well. It's not like the silver bullet, but actually people are often surprised to know that mental health issues in dogs can also be improved quite often by medication. So the key thing is going to see somebody who's qualified. Unfortunately, the kind of world of social media out there is full of kind of have-a-go heroes with dog behaviour. Mm. And a lot of them are unfortunately spreading misinformation that can be quite dangerous for the dogs and their owners.
Dr. Rowena Packer. The entertainment awards season will move into high gear this week with Tuesday's announcement of the Oscar nominations. But this year, it's not quite business as usual. Some potential awards contenders are pondering the relevance of Oscar's hoopla and the role of cinema in the midst of the conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine and a divisive presidential election campaign at home. From Los Angeles, Tom Brook reports.
This is Oscar night.
Congratulations, welcome to the Oscars.
The Academy is already busily promoting the Oscars ceremony with videos online, and in the run-up to the nominations announcement, stars and industry figures have been out on red carpets expressing their Oscar night hopes. But to some, it all seems a little trivial. Cinematographer Rodrigo Prieto could get Oscar nominations this week for his work on two films, Killers of the Flower Moon and Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
This whole thing, the awards and all that, is silly. And I think we have to accept that silliness and enjoy that. And, I mean, there is a balance to be had in the world, you know, the joy and the pain.
But potential awards contenders, many of them Academy voters, don't want to be silly in their choices this year. Strife in the real world is making them focus on certain films, like British director Christopher Nolan's blockbuster Oppenheimer, which portrays the man who led the team to develop the atomic bomb.
We imagine a future, and our imaginings horrify us.
Nolan's picture is expected to earn a trove of nominations. It certainly has the support of one-time Oscar nominee and actor and Academy voter Mary McDonnell.
Oppenheimer, I just can't get over it. We need to look at everything that we've done and are doing, politically and otherwise, particularly right now. You know, entertainment's great, but we're at a critical point on the planet.
Martin Scorsese's film Killers of the Flower Moon could also pick up votes. It throws light on an historic trauma, the murder of indigenous people in 1920s Oklahoma.
I'm a different kind of horse.
You talk too much. I don't care for watching horses.
Lily Gladstone, the film's indigenous American star, could conceivably win the Best Actress Oscar, although she faces strong competition.
It is highlighting and really humanizing a period of time and a people that have been so pushed aside in cinema. You know, American Indians, we're making our own movies and had a lively audience supporting everything that we did in the 1920s. To be able to be in a film like this that really fits in this chapter of film history that feels historic. All of it feels really historic. And to have the nation involved, Osage Nation involved so heavily.
Cinema can get audiences to engage and to think. Willem Dafoe could get nominated for his role in the dark comedy Poor Things, a satire of both social and self-oppression.
I can't let you go. Ah!
I love when I go to a movie and I see something and it reminds me of something I forgot or something that I didn't quite see before. And in tumultuous times like this, it's all the more important to see clearly and be compassionate with each other and be tolerant.
More than anything else, Hollywood old-timers like Harrison Ford think cinema can play a unifying role in times of division.
I think from at baseline, going into a movie theater, sitting in the dark with strangers and feeling your common humanity is the power of film. I think a story that brings us together emotionally it helps unite us in many different ways.
The nominations are...
With two blockbusters, Barbie and Oppenheimer, expected to both get multiple nominations, the Academy is hoping more people around the world will tune in to give the broadcast a significant ratings boost.
Tom Brook reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Muzetska and the producer was Sean Wales. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at a controversial temple being built on a contested holy site in India. Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi is opening what's been dubbed a Hindu Vatican. What does it mean for Hindus, for Muslims, and for Mr. Modi's political ambitions this election year? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.